Hello, and welcome again to No Killing Goblins. I'm Dragonus with my co-host, Oshi.
Hi, why do you do that voice?
Because I had to say hello, and I defaulted to, like, the customer service call center telemarketer training
I
I've
heard
done
it, like,
for a decade of my life.
You know, I've done the call center training. That's why I was like, why are you doing the voice? When did we get...
Because I said hello, and then I immediately defaulted to what I would say, or the way I would say it when I said hello, and once I started into it, it wasn't stopping.
Well, hi everybody. We're starting off our series on Book 6, The General of Israel, and we're all going to talk about The General of Israel, the wonderful Zell Shiver Trail and Pirate Abbott's sixth book in their massive and unstoppable series. It covers chapters 4.32G to chapter 4.449. The book was published for the first time. I did not even know this. Book was published on April 26th, 2022. And there's a bunch of major events and things, and we'll have like a general check-in here. And then we'll do a couple of episodes where we talk about specific, like, topics. We'll even have a guest in this short series, because I think we're going to have someone come in on the Goblins episode. We'll do a Goblins episode.
Yeah, it seems like we always bring guests in for the Goblins episode, too, now that I think about it.
I mean, that's usually the thing that most people like, and...
Yeah, the goblins are part of, like, the big draw of wandering in, and are definitely important, so it makes sense.
Well,
can't have all the fun ourselves.
Before we dive too much into the book and stuff, you want to talk about something recently gaming-wise for me? Have you noticed that as we've aged into our general, like, 30s, I am now rationing my gaming time, and I don't have any children? How did I end up rationing my gaming time even though I don't have children? What's happening?
I don't know. I just don't ration my gaming time.
How do you avoid not rationing your gaming time?
I work from home full time. My preferred method of cooking is making varieties of stew in the slow cooker.
Okay, that's it.
So I, yeah, I, or occasionally just because, okay, my insurance company is fucking stupid. I have to drive my car a couple times a week or they're going to make my insurance rates go up. But anyway, so I'll hop out and I'll maybe grab like a fucking Chick-fil-A biscuit or something for breakfast. But for the most part, yeah, it's work. It's cleaning during downtime at work. And then if I'm not at work, it's just fucking video games until I play fucking work again.
How dare you go to Chick-fil-A? How dare you? How dare you eat their wonderful food and support their Christian nationalist identifying stuff at the same time? How dare you not share that, like, chicken?
Listen, it is a difficult conundrum as a fucking queer man on what to do here, so I went to a Chick-fil-A and ate a biscuit to think it over, and then decided that I liked the chicken more than I hated the company. Jokes aside, I actually... If Chick-fil-A did not specifically donate money to homophobic causes, I would consider them the perfect company. They pay incredibly well. They give everybody a guaranteed day off. They have solid, clear... Because I've worked at a Chick-fil-A before, mm-hmm. a couple of them in town. Different franchisees. But the there is a very clear, from the top down, what is expected of a franchisor, and it will be followed. They give them a ton of support. When COVID hit and they had those people outside that walk the lines when it's a long line in order to help keep the lines moving quickly, they got them the most ridiculous giant fucking bubble suits to be in because they actually do prioritize employee safety and didn't want to deny that the fucking virus existed. I just, in general, think that they're a great example of, like, a company turning a profit while still acting ethically, and I just really wish they didn't donate money to fucking homophobia. That's just fucking so makes me... Anyways, before we go on...
Okay,
yes,
I'm gonna pause you here. I was letting you rant a little bit because I need to look this up. So, there is this hilarious podcasting duo, these two stars from, like, I think they were a housewife, former housewives or something, from Bravo, Jennifer Welch and Angie Sullivan. And they're just basic white women who live in Oklahoma and stuff, right? And their podcast has recently gone like big. It's called I've Had It. And they did like a crossover episode with Hassan Abi and all the streamers on Fear Ann. You know those folks like Austin Wild and all that stuff. And they were on the show and they told this story, like this theory about why Chick-fil-A is the way it is. It's because Chick-fil-A, I can't believe I'm repeating this. This is so insane. But watch that like episode if you want to know what the full theory is from their
I've
mouth.
got no interest in watching that at all.
But
By all means, please give me the
the
fucking.
theory is that Chick-fil-A targets the Christian kids who are homeschooled because they are so pent up, and that's why they have such they're so wonderful and so perfect because they have no like contact with the outside world except for when they get hired by Chick-fil-A. And this is where they find out how the rest of the world works. And they're so like desperate to get out of their trapped homes where they are taught from like nothing. They're homeschooled. They're trapped with their parents and have no idea how the rest of the world works because their internet is cut off except when their parents let them use it for homework. That the Chick-fil-A becomes their savior, their god, their way to get the fuck out of the house. And that's how they get it.
That's a fascinating theory. The two Chick-fil-A's I worked at, I'm gonna say that that does not track. There was nobody homeschooled there at either of them. And I'll also just be honest, I think it's just fucking they have standards. I've worked at every single fast food chain available in my region, and I can just safely say that there's just no standards.
I don't know. I think I like the podcast the most because despite being it's two white women, but it's also two white women bitching about how other white women should die. Like upper middle class and that kind of folks. Like they have colorful histories and all that, whatever. But what makes them interesting is that they're so willing to acknowledge the hypocrisy and stupidity of it. Like they were literally talked about the fact that people record themselves crying on social media. Which is a fascinating thing. Did you know the whole mommy bot, like, YouTubers, the mommy tubers or mom tubers or whatever? Did you hear about the woman who's going to jail for abusing her kids?
I did not go on.
There is this whole, like, icky infrastructure where lots of people would put their kids, their family bloggers, whatever. And they would use YouTube to monetize their children, right? And there was this, I think she's from Utah. God, why do they all have to be from Utah? She's from Utah and she had a partner. And hold on, let me just Google this very quickly because it's literally at the top.
Is this related to the well, I know the kind of thing you're talking about, right? Because there was that whole law in Illinois where you're actually required to compensate your children for
Yes.
putting them into social
Yeah,
media
it's part
bills.
of that whole movement because what's happening now is that people are finding out, as they do for any kind of thing with where children are exploited, that's, oh my God, children are being exploited to produce this content that we're watching. And a lot of people like love and watch family bloggers and they sort of idealize them. And there's this mommy blogger named Ruby Frank, who was an influencer, and she would say some pretty radical things about like how to treat your kids and how to raise them and all that stuff. But she projected this I'm a great mother kind of situation, and it turns out her kids were being like starved and abused, and one of her kids escaped from her house to her neighbors. And these neighbors didn't even know she was a mommy blogger. They just knew that this woman was like a fucked up woman who was abusing her children. And it just ca all came out, and now more and more like mommy bloggers are being examined, or people are actually asking the question. Maybe it's not a good idea to let people birth children and then put them on camera for money.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong. I think that it's not. This has been a problem outside of the mommy blogger, daddy blogger, family blogger, whatever you want to call it, sphere for a long time now with like child stars and actors. And if anybody's ever read Jenna McCurdy's book, you
Oh
know,
my God, that's such a good book.
yeah.
Yeah.
But I think that this is. There are even less, and this is going to sound wild to say, there are less safety rails here than there are for child actors in Hollywood with abusive parents. And that's scary.
Not everybody turns into who's the flower child who has her own talk show, Drew Barrymore. Not everybody survives like Drew Barrymore does. Most people end up like, who's the guy who offed himself when he was 17? Too many of them to count.
Yeah, or. There's all sorts of things to it. And also, you know, sometimes you get parents who are ethical human beings who treat their child right, and then the child now has a strong social media presence and can kind of do whatever they want in life and a bunch of money in the bank. But that's like really not what's happening.
That rarely, if ever,
Actually, you know
happens.
what is somebody who pops up in my YouTube shorts whenever I'm doom scrolling, really very crunchy, fucking, oh my God, I can't remember her name.
While you try to
Emily something.
remember her name, the reason I'm
Well,
mentioning
no, the
all of.
name of the channel is like really very crunchy.
Oh,
But one
okay.
thing I like about them is they never put their children on the screen. You'll occasionally hear their voice or see a shot from the back of their head, but they're very conscious of not showing their children. Right? The stuff that they do, it's jokes about their relationship and her being kind of a crazy, crunchy homeschooler mom, but it's self-aware enough to make jokes about how weird she can be about that. And it seems like it's all very healthy, and she never once puts her fucking children on the screen. And I respect that so much.
I want to, like, we're going to talk about this later in a later episode, but the reason I'm talking about all this, about the fame game, about the consequences of it, and of people projecting a particular, like, persona, a more po like for a here's one that happens for a more positive reason. I'm going to connect it back. Like, God, I guess we're not ready to talk. I don't know. I want to dive into. Oh my God, Google Chrome can go fuck itself. What I was gonna say is, I want to talk a lot about something that's going to come up. There's a YouTube. There is a YouTuber named Matt Baum, who talks a lot about like queer folks before the watershed moments of the 2000s and stuff, where queer folks in the United States were more accepted. At about like folks from the 50s, 60s, actors and stuff who had to stay closeted for a very long time and who had to live lies, essentially. Even today, not a lot of people know like certain actors are or were gay and had to live a life that was very contained and controlled. Otherwise, they would be ostracized and left out. And you know why I'm talking about this, so help me here out here.
Sorry, I'll admit you said Matt Baum, and I immediately went, "Oh yeah, Matt Baum. I love that fucking guy." And I have actually kind of lost where you were going.
Well, the reason I'm talking about Matt Baum is because he talked a lot about.
Oh, is this about certain characters in the future who are actually in the
No,
closet?
in this book.
Yeah.
Why am I being coy? It's Zell. It's fucking Zell. I'm trying to talk about Zell, damn it.
They actually decloset him next book because it's actually not until his will.
No,
Although there's hints in this
no,
book.
no,
Oh,
no,
there are
no, no.
hints in this book.
This is where I figured it out. This might
I
not be
mean,
where
yeah,
most people figured it
same.
out, but this is where I figured it out. Like,
It wasn't official until then, and I didn't know if we were considering it a spoiler or not. So
I don't consider
you
it a
derailed
spoiler.
me.
You know why? Because I spent a lot of time thinking, this guy, is he?
Like,
Like,
yeah, for like, there's a really early conversation where it's asking him about fucking kids that always makes me giggle too.
oh my God, so much. Like, a lot of it is like, Pirate probably, I don't know how skilled they are at like representing folks in the closet, or Zell never really felt like he was in the closet. It's just he never talked about it. Like,
It's the difference between like how I'm in the closet, where it's generally an open secret, but I don't specifically want certain family members with money who'll disown me to know, and being in the closet, where you're like fucking only the closest of your personal friends and family know.
or nobody knows, and you have sex in the background with random people on the way. Like, it's just, there is an entire, like, structure to Zell, the public persona, and the person that we got to know across the story that we carry on. Like, he's the titular character of this book, the General of Israel. We got to find out more and more about him, his place in the world, how he views himself, his failures, his wishes and hopes. We got to feel like Zell is someone who's always going to be there. He even has a moment with the fucking Antinium kids where he teaches them how he crosses one of the greatest divides for him personally and teaches this Antinium how to help someone comfort another human being who's dying. Like, well, I'm saying human being, but with, you know what I mean.
Another person.
Yeah, another
But
person.
yeah, that was such a water, like just a fucking, I almost said watershed, but that's not right. That was a paradigm shift for him.
Yes.
Because the Antinium that he's known have always been the Antinium as, frankly, the kind of queens want them to be. Mindless monsters who do nothing but obey and feel no fear. And to realize that they can, and that this is a possibility, and that the world is so much different than he thought, and he lives up to that fucking challenge.
That is what made Zell so impressive as a character. And this was before I figure I like before the confirmation of his gayness. I still thought he was one of the best characters the Fire had written up until that point. And then killing him was probably one of the most epic scenes. Like the structure of how the chapter was written out, the way it was all laid out. I think it was done very, very well. I think people won't necessarily appreciate that and the nuances of like the hidden meaning of him talking about naming Rie, like, is that how you pronounce it? Rice?
I would put
Rice?
rice.
Okay, Rice. Naming Rice and the way he talks about the child and then about we find, I'm not even spoiling this because this is all stuff he talks about his law, like his true love. He thinks about his true love for a moment about his about Ceres. Like all of this is like laying out at the core of like if you've been paying attention to Drakes, if you've been paying attention to the society, how they are like pretty conservative, pretty like built around image and sort of what people think of you and all these
Deeply
things.
hierarchical.
Yeah, deeply hierarchical. And the two people who were so completely considered the sons of Drake society are gay, in love with each other, and would have had a family if they'd survived. Like, I love that.
Maybe it would be a totally different place if they did too. That's the real tragedy of it. But instead, you have fucking Zell, who we know is, despite being arguably the greatest general on the continent, working fucking job to job for fucking city to city for these smaller leagues, just trying to help avoid them getting pushed around. We find out that he's, clearly, his secret must have been out because the man did not have the authority of his rank that he should have. And it just makes it all the more tragic when he dies the way he does, because he was the one person, after all of the stuff that he had, all of the lessons of the inn, he reaches out and he goes to fucking Magnolia and he gives this speech that is gonna have ramifications all the way as recently as the most recent book to these fucking nearby humans that he's just in charge of for the fucking moment, and he puts everything he has into it anyways. And is so badass.
Yeah, it's so badass. But before we dive too much more into like Zell and his awesomeness, let's talk a little bit about some of the pieces that went into the book with the major events that happen. And oh, the cover. So I love the cover. All of the covers are done by of Pirate Abbott's books are done by at least in The Wandering Inn are done by the same cover artist, which is JAD, John Anthony DiGiovanni, who's like a big artist for like pup trade traditional publishers and traditional writers too, and Pirate has him locked down or whatever. I love this design. Magnolia in the back, just a little bit shorter. Ressa with her boobs out, poking the scene, the way the thing
You
is.
know, I had never noticed that, but yeah, holy shit, Ressa is stacked.
How could you not? I'm gay. Well, actually, you know what? I can understand you, but I'm gay. Because you know why I notice it is because it's the exact silhouette for like half the drag queens in like drag like I see on the internet. Like it's the exact like the giant boobs like out to here with the perfect like hour like the rest of it is hourglass figure. All she needs is like 3 foot tall heels and ridiculous shoulders and she'd be a perfect drag queen. But I'm gonna say this right now. So drakes don't tend to be put on the covers of stuff often, and I have one objection with the depiction of drakes. I will continue to hate this. Why the fuck do they have to look like they're standing on tippy toe of their claws? Because what is with that weird bent leg thing? That is how is that? What is that a thing? That is not anatomically possible. You can't have that kind of a foot and be able to walk around. Like it just,
Are
I
we
can't do it.
really getting into the fucking nitty-gritty of the giant bipedal dragon people with boobs and but we're going to talk about the
You know
exact
what? You know
specific
what? I
mechanics?
am willing to fight over this because it pisses me the fuck off. It is probably the only thing that ever like about any of the design choices the pirate and all the artists have made that pisses me truly pisses me off. Because most of the rest of the stuff makes sense to me or have some conclusion. This one, if they're giant dragon people, why would they have their like feet be that unsupported? And easily, like, is it because they need their fucking giant tails to stand upright? Because that's the only way I would accept it.
I didn't even notice this until you mentioned it, and I will have forgotten it by the end of this conversation.
Fuck. Okay, fine. Fine. But
I've
let's.
always been caught up like the tail, the like a little barding armor that he's got on his tail, the breastplate. That's always been what's drawn my eye. I hadn't even realized that Magnolia and Ressa were in the background because this
Nobody
is.
pays attention to the covers. Like,
Well,
I.
we normally do, but for some reason, this one I had never really looked at, so it kind of just went past me. Because, yeah, I couldn't tell you. Anyways, yeah, so, Drake feet are weird, and oh, she's gonna be weird about it.
This scene depicted on the cover is Magnolia and Ressa presenting the what was it called? The something flame breastplate? Dragon flame? Heart flame.
Heart flame.
Yeah, heart flame breast. It's some relic of the Drakes that he never actually figures out how to use, which is so sad for him. Maybe it would have helped him survive. But let's dive into the major events list because I actually like this. I love the fact that Kylara wrote out all the major events that happened in the book. So, for I'm gonna list you wanna talk about each of them or you wanna like
I mean, we definitely should hit the high points. At least, like, so for this book, oh, actually, weirdly enough, doesn't even stand out to me as much because of Zell. Like, this is gonna sound weird, but Zell dying was such a shocking moment, in part because he feels kind of low key throughout the book. He feels like a character who's building to something, and Pirate is the master at this, finding the best time to kill a character so that you feel like their arc is unfulfilled, because that's how you get the most impactful fucking deaths.
But let's major events that happen. So the first one is Tom, because we have the clown chapters and we're gonna have an episode where we talk about that. The clown chapters that cover like Rear and his struggles with his sanity and the Blighted
Tom's
King's.
having a bad time.
Yeah, and he's having a bad time. And the Blighted King's palace is attacked by demons, and it's revealed that the fool who's part of the Blighted King's court, is a traitor. And you also get to see how fucking insane any class could be, because the fool literally uses his fool skills to fuck with everybody.
Yeah, he's such a masterful acrobat. He can throw accurately, juggle, he can do weird hammer space stuff with both other people's attacks and his own. And Tom definitely learns from him. And while Tom doesn't have his panache, he does have a certain serial killer, horror movie monster-esque determination to him. And brutality. You can't forget the brutality.
Oh God, we do. And so Tom does defend the palace and slays the fool, but in the process he sort of breaks his brain, and the fool, as he dies, reveals that in order to summon the Earth Kids, the unborn children of the kingdom were sacrificed.
Yeah, and apparently it was not at a great exchange rate.
No, I think it was like 10 to 1, so every Earth Kid cost 10 children. And not even children that are alive. Like, I don't know why Pirate chose unborn children. I would have gone with, like, living children.
No, it's because it's potential. It is sacrificing a generation of a potential generation and the potential they could have brought to your nation to instead bring over these children from another world. It makes sense thematically like that. Also, we don't know what the real exchange rate is. This is, I think, before Rear realized just how many people from Earth had been dropped all over the world.
And the spell's cost is the spell's cost. We'll find out more about that shit later. We also have the next big event that happens. We're gonna build up to the end of the book, but the next big event that happens is Laken is building his relationships with the neighboring cities, and goblins are starting to attack, like, the local villages, and he rescues Lady Rye from Tremberag's forces. We get to meet Tremberag, we get to meet Lady Rye, we get to see Laken trying to, like, developing his opinion of what the goblins are.
And this is something I think we maybe will have to dig a little bit more into, just because
That's why we have
there's
the goblin
not a whole.
episode.
Well, I don't know if we have a specific episode set aside for him. And honestly, this is just bog standard nation building, politics, learning to rule stuff. I just think this is notable and should be talked about a bit because this is yet more bad experiences with Laken and goblins. Especially Tremberag goblins, who are kind of the worst.
Yeah.
And I think it's something important to consider about Laken, who he is, the way his experiences in this world have shaped him, and something he's gonna do later on.
And, like, more shenanigans happen with the goblins with Bethel, Bethel Welkaz, who is,
Well, she is.
well, whatever, with who is, like, very French for some fucking reason. And her Petal Knights attack Rag's forces, and then Grey Death visits the Flooded Water Tribes and to see Rags and see if she's, like,
I
and
mean,
then judges
he
her
was
as
pretty
not
much there
enough.
the whole time,
Yeah, but
and he reveals himself and is like, "Yeah, I had to chase these people away. Like, you got it, but you don't quite got it yet, kid." And then just fucking leaves.
and then he go I think we, like, go along with Grey Death as he visits the different potentials. I don't know what he's looking. Sorry, we don't know what he's looking for, but he looks in on all the big bad goblins of the story, and he looks in on Rags. He looks in on the Goblin Lord, the one that is serving.
And if you want to talk about big spoilers, in that episode, we're going to have a big spoiler warning for one part of that conversation. Because I rereading this and understanding a bit more about what Grey Death is up to has definitely.
Yes, and he heads to Tremberag and Garen and all that stuff. Meanwhile, the Red Fang Five end up finally, after being lost and all their friends dying and all the, like, East Helm adventurers, they finally get to the inn and rescue Eren from some eater goats. And of course, Eren immediately adopts him.
I can finally start talking about my boys.
Oh, God. We have an episode for it, so not now.
Yeah.
That's tomorrow.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Their silver swords also arrive, finally. Yvonne's brother, Yloz, arrives to take her home, and that goes about as well as can be expected.
Yeah, and I feel sorry for poor Laws, because on the one hand, he's being very dense about this. But I will say, I understand where he's coming from, that the idea that his, beloved little sister has received terrible, potentially crippling, life-altering injuries that she is insisting on ignoring to try and go out and adventure anyways. And that cannot be an easy thing. And yes, she's her own person, but there's also a lot of fucking laws and rules in place for when people act irrationally, in ways that are clearly likely to cause harm to themselves and others. And I don't think Ivlana is there yet, but
Oh
she's
no, she's
also,
there.
I don't think, acting super rationally. Well, there's things she knows that other people don't, because there's stuff like Pisces and wait, have we gotten to Pisces coming up
No,
yet?
I'll get into it, but I'm trying to say that by any definition of our modern world, she'd be in a straitjacket going through recovery right now, not around normal people, because she probably would have killed somebody by now. What I'm gonna, or she'd be one of those subway people. There's like, speaking of Pisces, there's two things that happen sort of around the same time. So Yellow Spatters, who is freaking out, trying to figure out like what he wants out of the world and all these things.
And he knows what he wants. What his problem is, what he wants is for the Antinium around him to survive and stop dying.
But
And
that's not necessarily going to happen.
it's
So.
never gonna happen because he's being callously used by his fucking overlords, fucking I almost said Kissimver, Kilbekich and the Queen, and his life is one of suffering and sadness.
And
And
he has to find some reason to keep going, and we get to go on his little journey for that. I'm calling it Little Journey, but honestly, it's a pretty affecting chapter, and I liked it. And then they do find a sort of solution for the problem of all these Antinium dying, or Yellow Splatters finally figures out that no, he's not the only person who has to solve all these problems. He has his friends and family and like
he's
other
not the only
Antinium.
person who cared, and he wasn't being used as callously as he felt like he was from a middle management perspective.
The Antinium essentially like figure out how to create a kill box inside the dungeon entrance into the hive, which has been one of the biggest reasons why so many Antinium have been dying in the free hive, and now not as big of a problem anymore.
And it's such a cool moment too, because it's a great character moment for the various Antinium tacticians and their differences. And I thought it was really cool, especially because it came with a nice little twist on it that I'll love to dig into when we get there.
When we get there,
And then, of
if
course,
we,
we have the Red Fangs.
and the, oh, yes, but also around the same time, not coincidentally, Pisces and Olesim figure out that Kalruz might still be alive in the dungeon, which is pretty significant. And the stabilization of the dungeon entrance, the arrival of the Red Fang Five, the Silver Swords, who decide to stick around even when Yavlan absolutely does not want to go home. All of this stuff is like centers around the dungeon, and there's like a build up over time that there's something that's gonna come out of the dungeon again. And last book, which was, oh my God, I can't remember. I can't say the name of the last book. This is not book eight. So this is General of Israel. This is the end of. Okay, it's not come, but the stuff, something's coming out of the dungeon in terms of a narrative point of view. And just as all of this comes to a head, Magnolia finally convinces Zell to join her in the fight against the Goblin Lord. And Zell takes his leave of Lescore. He says goodbye to everybody, like, tells them all things are going to be okay, gets in Magnolia's carriage, and goes off to see Magnolia at her mansion. And in between all that, we get to find out what happened in the Second Antinium War. Pirate does history, which is pretty cool. Like, it's a recitation. We get to.
Yeah,
Yeah.
and it was really fun, especially like I
Crystal
Chris
Wordsmith?
Cecil Wordsmith is without a doubt my favorite character that we've
Oh,
never
God.
seen on screen. I want to see him so badly. I want to see his name on more books too.
Oh
This
my
guy is
God,
fucking great.
may that never happen because I will punch a fucker.
But Paba clearly struggled with this one, which it makes sense. This is very much outside Paba's style. It's almost epistolary, but with all the occasional asides and cutting to different characters. Like it was definitely, especially for Paba at the time, a huge departure, and I could imagine it being a fun challenge, but it turns out it wasn't very fun.
No. It's one of those things where I think their current system would probably have helped them avoid all those problems because they could have just put up a, hey, historians, help me make this make sense, and they would have probably helped them with it. But.
And honestly, no, the thing is, it makes sense and it works, especially with the context of, as time goes on, Chrysalis becoming much more,
Biased? Inaccurate? Dumb fuck? But regardless,
opinionated, might be,
whatever. So we hear a lot about the Second Antonine War, and of course Pirate eventually draws the parallels to like lays out what happened with all the battles between the Antinium, the Azkaresh, the Goblin Lord, all of the stuff that happened, at least from the Drake perspective. We don't actually get to know a whole lot about what happens with the humans of the North. We find that out later because Chris Sissel is like a fuckwit who's obsessed, who has to sell this book, these books to the Drakes. And then, of course, we get the with the unfortunate sequence at the end. Not unfortunate as in it's bad, but just like sad sequence at the end as the eventually named Rhys becomes the Goblin Lord, attacks an army that Zell that Magnolia has gathered. That is not really well put together, but Zell makes it into a force, and Azkaresh takes this opportunity to use his children to trap Zell and kill him. I was so grateful that Zell, like, and Azkaresh realizes by the end of that fight that he's fucked, because it all his powers and all his kids, and Zell ended up, like, murdering a bunch of them before he even died. And he only died because he was willing to die. I truly believe this. He was willing to die to end the war. Like he, it felt like he was putting out a message. He dies, and Azkaresh goes away, and the people behind him survive. Right?
No, I think what happened, like the death, I don't think he was like up until the moment he got touched by the Doom Plague, Bay. Was it Bay? Bia?
No, it's is
Oom.
the yeah.
Oom is the plague one, yeah. No, I thought Oom, no, Oom's the
No,
ooze.
Bay is the plague one. Is the reason he died because he got past the defenses and ripped apart all of his scales and all that bullshit.
No. So when gets to him, he kills by literally ordering the golem that was trying to crawl in. He or to fucking laser beam him so that he could have it laser beam at the same time, and then he walks out basically just minorly singed and then cracks fucking Oom's soul gem thing in half, right?
Ooh, yeah, that I
No,
do remember. Okay,
Bay
you're
is the
right.
reason he died, because the second Bay touched him, he was as good as dead, and he realized that, so he turned and stopped fighting defensively and started tearing them to shreds. And he even almost got his hands on fucking Azkaresh again, too, because this is the first example we really see of high-level characters. I'm sorry, they don't fucking have any quit in them. You can be missing most of your head and perforated all over and have all of this terrible stuff happen to you, and you're still moving. You're still calling out your skills and fucking barely missing beheading the goddamn guy who admittedly probably wouldn't even have cared at that point. He clearly has something fucking going on there. But real fucking talk, like, that is a scary amount of just sturdiness.
I guess I think Zell is also like overly sturdy for a character specific. Like he specialized in being sturdy, so maybe he's not the perfect, but I understand perfectly what you're trying to say. He is like a pinnacle of something and is very, very
Yeah,
powerful.
and we see this as time goes on too, that like there might be other people who aren't as specialized in him at it, but we find out some more details why later. But high level people are just fucking tough.
I do love that we all like there is like drawing back into this also. Like, we do find out about other groups of really high level, really powerful people because we get this history summary. Like, Zern is talked about, and Zern and the Free Queen and stuff talk about the fact that the Centinium were the equivalent of Zell for them, right? But for the Antinium, excuse me. The Centinium being like the heroes of the Antinium, the high level, specialized, powerful people. Which begs the question of what the fuck happened with Kilbukich, and what why he isn't like super amazing powerful. Like during the history lesson, we get told about these Centinium that were so dangerous that they took out entire armies. Like it, there's so much we find out in the last like set of chapters, including like the Sacrifice of Roses with how all of these ladies came out. Like, there's so many things that are talked about that we only get the glimpse
It's
of.
such a grand story, and the best thing about it, it's a story I would read.
Exactly.
Also, like we know the reason why Kilbukich is so fucking weak. It's because Zell Shivertail picked him up and fucking broke him into pieces so many times he lost all of his good levels.
And it's just, I really loved that lore drop. And the way it was paired with the end of it, because in that moment, all of the chickens come home to roost. Ass Crush is still alive. Magnolia is still around. Zell is now dead, but the Antinium are in a different place. Things are like shifting and moving. And Pirate has all of these like balls that they have rolling forward, and they give this indication that this is the end of one conflict that has never ended. But there's a new one on the horizon, and we don't know how it will end, but it's gonna involve goblins. That's all I was able to get at the end of this.
Yeah, we are closing in on it.
The goblins, Liscor, and something's coming in the horizon, and we're all sad Zell's dead. And I guess that wraps up the actual book itself, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
And oh, that this was also the end of volume four, right? Because
Yeah,
that's how Pirate always ends it,
this
right?
was the end of the volume. This was what Volume 4 built up to. And Volume 5 is going to be just not the summation of its own story, but the summation of all five volumes, really. It is very much, I think, the first major arc of The Wandering Inn, as I mark by the amount of fucking just bullshit and trauma that Erin is going through, forging her into who she is. 10 volumes later, 11 volumes later, 20 volumes later. I don't know how many of these fucking pirates still plans to put
We'll
out.
see. We'll see. I'll be here for as long as Pirate keeps writing. But that's just general overview of what happens in the General of Israel. We're gonna do three more episodes. One to talk about the beloved goblins and how that meshes with Magnolia and Zell. Another to talk about Liscor, the dungeon, the Red Fang Five, and then a last one we're gonna chat
Dedicated
about.
to the clown.
Yeah, it's not just the clown, but also like Rear, the themes being explored there, the kind of story Pirate was trying to do, and what people thought of it, because it did have a pretty divisive like opinion, like even more so than typical.
And I'm definitely a part of that, if nothing else. And we're not going to get into my really spicy Rear and fucking Blighted Kingdom opinions for a long while, but.
Thank God. Thank you for listening, guys, and we'll see you soon. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
You've been listening to No Killing Goblins,
edited by Liquid Ender.
The music on No Killing Goblins was composed by System Glitch. They can be found at youtube.com/systemglitch. You can get in touch with us via our Twitter at No Killing Goblin, or email us at nokillinggoblins with an S at gmail.com.